about the loving, tender care with which Oscar has managed our coffee and food and preparations for this year-long adult education program. And Oscar, we're grateful to you. The food, though, it was not always gourmet, it was always large and plentiful. I want to try out some ideas on you tonight. I'm not sure they're right. I don't claim to be an historian of the family. But I think that they're worth thinking about. I find them intriguing. The more I deal with them, the more and more convinced I am that there is a basic validity to them. And if they are right, they put much of the conventional, widespread wisdom about the family into a different perspective. For in our straight society, and you and I are all part of that straight society, there's a great deal of hand-wringing and a great deal of breast-beating. There's a tendency to feel that the family is disintegrating and that somehow attendant to the disintegration of the family is a disintegration of civilization itself. That without the family, there may not be the capacity within the social order to train up another generation in values, in any sense of traditional virtue, to love and to accept love, to be empathetic. And if anything, the subject of the family has been, at least in the popular press, the subject of woe and doom-speaking and jeremiads that are somewhat endless. And the evidence, of course, is to a certain degree overwhelming, the mounting rate of divorce. I don't know what the rate of divorce is. I keep seeing different statistics about it, but it's something between 1 in 3, 1 in 4 marriages which are celebrated or contracted end up in divorce. Of course, there's an ancillary statement to that that very few people talk about. That is, almost everybody who gets divorced gets married again. That the institution of marriage itself is still seen to be basic to one's happiness, if not to the social order. Then there's the impact of the liberation of youth, which began about 50 or 80 years ago. As we increased the demands of the school system, we needed a more competent, more human resource. We began keeping our youngsters in school beyond the 6th grade and beyond the 8th grade. The peer group pressures are the dominant pressures. The ability of the family to mold the values of adolescence has decreased markedly. They're out of our homes more than they are in our homes, and very clearly from all the evidence, their values are determined by their generational group rather than by their family setting. And finally, and most disturbing to some, has been the liberation of women. The mother was looked upon in many quarters as the last linchpin of the tent that holds the family together. At least she was there, cooking and sewing and doing whatever mothers are traditionally assumed to have done. And then when she went out to go to work or to go back to school or to do one thing or another, somehow the home seemed to become an empty place, a place devoid of adults, and therefore, in a sense, no home at all. I guess the mood that you might characterize the conventional wisdom as being in is in the nostalgic phase. Good old days, good old families. The extended family, you know, mother and father and children and grandparents and maybe some maiden aunts around the place and a brother who had been brought over from the old country who was living here till he got himself established and a couple of yeshiva bachers who were eating days, to use the old phrase, your Case Western Reserve students who were in the days before the dormitories. And most of us look back with a good bit of nostalgia, not upon those kinds of homes, but upon what those homes developed into, a nuclear family, by which we mean a husband and a wife, father and a mother, and the siblings and children until they reached college age. They were warm places. We felt devoted to our parents. We felt very close to them. And we came to feel that there was something that was right, basic in the home. It seemed to be confirmed by everything that our religious tradition taught us. Now, I'm all in favor of the home. And the home, obviously, was a miniature world. It seemed to be a secure and rooted place, a place where there were a number of cross-generational experiences, a place where the child was trained up in the way that he would go, and presumably a place in which the adults would have a meaningful and deep relationship. But if we look at the history of the family, I would suggest to you that most of our memories are drawn from a very unique moment in history, a kind of family situation which existed for a very short span, maybe two generations, and was never stable, and that we could not have expected, really, given the structure, I'll try to make this point in a minute, that this family, this nuclear family that we had would survive. And that if we look back at the so-called good old days, they weren't so good after all. That the extended family was poor, lacked privacy, there was very little chance for intimacy between adults, much less between adults and children. It was a product of what they call a small traditional community, where the community was coherent, and that gave what coherence the family had rather than the family structure itself. And then in point of fact, and this I think will be the most startling thing I'll try and make tonight, the family unit for most of history, at least most of European history, at least for most of Ashkenazic Jewish history in Europe, the family was not a place of intimacy, of warmth, of communication, of domesticity, of human relationship at all. It was cold and affectless, and it was not designed to be an emotional unit at all, or a place where a person came to self-fulfillment. It was a survival unit and an economic necessity. And that there was very little interest in or demand for the family to be the place in which we found friendship, love, expressed love, or any of the emotional relationships which are so important to us and which we sort of instinctively associate with family life. Now let me review basically the history. In the small communities of Europe, the small traditional communities, what George Simmel, the noted European sociologist, called the Gemeinschaft. The community, whether it was the larger non-Jewish community of farmers and peasants, or the small shtetl community, or the small ghetto community, was a small place. Numbers were relatively insignificant by modern standards. You numbered households in the tens, or at most in the hundred, not in the thousands and in the millions. It was a small place. It was a place where the community outside was coherent. It was a place in which the stem family or the extended family was the order of the day. We know a great deal about the formal relationships which established marriage, which maintained marriage, which permitted divorce, the formal standards of the community. We know very little about the internal life of these families. It's to that attention that I'm going to try and take you in a moment. And then with urbanization, with the Industrial Revolution, with the Jew, with emancipation, and with proto-capitalism, the Jew comes to the family a little bit earlier than the modern family, a little bit earlier than other people. With all that makes for modern life, the family gets trimmed down. Where the peasant family or the family which had a cottage industry, where the tailor shop or whatever it was in the home itself, you needed a lot of extra hands. It was a busy place. And you took in whoever needed to be taken in. But now, as you move from the coherent small traditional community into the larger urban center, instead of this community around you being coherent, that is, being like you, being open and a place where your equals, your peers existed, the community now was the enemy. The community was alien. It was strange. You need to lock your door against it. You also needed to be mobile. You had left your roots. You were moving, and you went wherever opportunity took you. And now, instead of a community, as it had been in medieval times, a coherent place an established place, a place where the guild, where cooperation, where neighborliness was the basic order of things. The new order was free enterprise. The new order was capitalism, which means competition. You were against everybody else. And more the family threw up walls against the outside world, a hard shell. And that's nuclear family. You paired off the uncles and the aunts in part because of space. The city is crowded, and the maiden aunt can find an apartment in the city, and you don't need her help around the house. And the children are sent off as early as you can to dormitories. You can't keep them in the limited space you have. And the old folk are sent off to whatever the proto-version of Montefiore or Menorah Park may have been, to institutions. The city provides a number of institutions, and the family is an economic unit which seals itself off from an alien competitive world. And now, for the first time, as I'll try and show in a moment, the questions of affect, of feeling, of relationship come into the family. In the traditional family, there was very little basic human relationship. In the nuclear family, in the large urban community, husbands and wives began to talk with each other for the first time. They began to become friends for the first time. They began to find the complexity that intimacy brings out in any human relationship, and to draw strength and a sense of their own awareness, self-awareness out of those relationships. And the family takes on a totally new context, the context that we're familiar with, that we associate with the family, the things that we are unhappy about giving up. But until this last 100 years or so, this was not what was meant by family. And now, as we move into another kind of revolution, a revolution which is paring down the family even further, pulling the children out, pulling the husband out first. He began to leave the home to go to work about 100 years ago and stopped coming home to lunch about 50 years ago. And then the wife started going to work about 25 years ago, and she'll more and more be out of the home. Now we're going to another period of change, the long-term results of which we can only begin to guesstimate, but which we obviously have to take into account. Now, if I am correct, and this is in fact a model which makes some kind of sense, if the traditional family was really not the place of socialization, of feeling, of emotion, of acculturation, then in point of fact, Judaism existed and thrived for hundreds of years, not because of the family, but almost despite the family. It was in fact the community itself which created Jewish identity. It was in fact the community itself which established what were called Jewish values. It was out in the community that one established one's basic Jewish relationships. And that it was not in the home as we have come to assume it to be. Now the home that we have is a home which is under attack. The nuclear family has been pared down once again, as I've suggested, and more than that, the nuclear family has been subverted. And it's been subverted by the television set. Once upon a time, when your children came home, you closed the door, and you had a unified world. Whatever the family was like, that was the context of your life. But now the outside world intrudes. You can't close your door to the tube. And that tube in most American homes is going most of the time people are awake. And as a result, the family itself is no longer acculturating people to whatever its peculiar and special and unique set of values are. Those values are not only tempered by all the centrifugal forces outside, pulling the child, pulling the adult away from the family unit, but by what happens now for the first time within the home, where the jingle of the commercial world, of whatever 3 or 4 or 5 television managers decide should come into your home, in fact enters there. And that's neither good nor bad per se. It's simply, it's the context in which we have to ask the question, is the family irreplaceable? And if it's not irreplaceable, what will replace it? If it is irreplaceable, ought we to throw up our hands and surrender and join zero population growth, except take it to its logical extreme, just not have any children at all? And can, obviously, within that context, can Judaism survive the end of the family? Now, there are two obstacles, which I must admit to you, that I face in making this case. They both have to do with the nature of the evidence. When I began to think along these lines, I went to our library, which now numbers about 25,000 volumes, and I did a rather careful job of research, and there isn't a single volume in our library which presents a history of the Jewish family. There's not a single volume which presents the sociodynamics of the family over a long period of time. There's a great deal of information on the Jewish family taken in the last 50 years by sociological statisticians, by the psychologists and the counselors and all these people who have worked so effectively among us. But it all assumes a model which had already emerged, the modern family. We know almost nothing about the internal life of the pre-modern family. And I mean by that something, whatever existed 150 years ago and before. There's almost no kind of evidence. What we have to build on is, first of all, a good bit of legal evidence. We know what the forms of family organization were. That's very different from content. We know how an engagement was arrived at, and how a marriage was celebrated, and what were the conjugal responsibilities as stipulated by law of husband and wife. We know what the responsibilities under law were of the parent in terms of the training and education of a child. We know what were the practices vis-a-vis divorce. All these things we know because the legal code sets it to us. But we could no more define the context of American family life just from our legal codes than we can define the inner life of the Jewish family from the post-Talmudic legal documentation of our Jewish tradition. And the other kind of evidence that we have comes from the sermons, the Musar, the ethical elements in our life. And most of these tend to be, in medieval times, hellfire and damnation, finger-pointing, a condemnation by one who is obviously of the elite, the intellectual rabbinic elite of the community which he is designed to deal with. And he assumes a high code of traditional moralities, and when the community fails to live up to it, or an individual does, he points the finger and cries sin. Now, that also does not tell us a great deal, because the sins are usually an objective phenomenon rather than a subjective one. A girl becomes pregnant out of marriage, and all of a sudden the immorality has come into the community. And we have to try and understand what that means and in what context it is given. Now, the one thing we do know from both these kinds of literature, and what I know from whatever history I've studied, is this. The traditional Jewish marriage was entered into by arrangement between families, that the basis for these arrangements was economic, to provide for the young couple, that the young couple did not meet till the engagement or the wedding. There was no pretense within this European 15th, 16th, 17th century social society at romance. There was no real care of whether the young couple was compatible. It was assumed that if they came out of similar socioeconomic backgrounds, they would by definition be compatible. Once the marriage took place, whichever partner in the marriage left the family, left the hometown, almost completely dropped out of sight as far as the family was concerned. There are very few surviving groups of letters from mother to daughter, to married daughter, from father to married son, unless a commercial arrangement is involved. Families sometimes stay together for reasons of trade. They never, as far as we can tell from the documents, stayed together for reasons of feeling. Once the daughter left the home, out of sight was out of mind. You'd done your job. There's very little evidence of mother love, or father love, or of intimacy between husband and wife. In other words, there's very little evidence from the documents of affect, of feeling. of the basic things which we consider so important to a family. That much we can tell from the legal and the Musar literature. And the second issue which we must face as we try and understand, and the second admission really I must make, is to the weakness of the historical documentation which I have to present to you, is the fact that when the modern family emerges, and Jewish life falls in love with the modern family and declares it to be Jewish, in largest part because the family is a creation of the middle class, the bourgeoisie in the 18th and 19th century. This was the class that the Jews wanted desperately to join. We Jews had in Central and Western Europe a running start into capitalism. We were the proto-capitalists, and we'd already moved to a certain degree in the 17th and 18th century into this, these kinds of relationships. We declared them, in the family relationships, the new family relationships, somehow to be Jewish. And I can find you in our library hundreds and hundreds of sermons, magazine articles, one thing or another, which waxes eloquent on the importance of the family in Jewish tradition, and which finds one place or another in the old literary tradition a text, which then they use as a proof text of the importance of the family. And we immediately assume that what we mean by family has been meant by family since time immemorial. There's a classic example of it yesterday at the Temple Women's Association service. The ladies who spoke beautifully. And what they said essentially was, we have had wonderful childhoods. We've enjoyed our families. Our families were close and they were strong and obviously they were Jewish. And because of that, the Jewish family is a great thing, has always been a great thing. And one of the ladies used a text from the Talmud which reads, of the man who loves his wife as himself, honors her more than himself, who guides his son and daughter in the right way and arranges for their early marriage, scripture says, and quotes Job, you shall know that your tent is in peace. Now everyone who listened, except myself, because in part I was thinking of the lecture I was going to give tonight, translate these terms, honor, love, guidance, into modern 20th century terms. But what did love mean in 4th or 5th century Babylon? This is an Oriental society. It's a polygamous society. It's a society where the external world has put its women into harem and treats them as completely as sexual objects. Love means in those days not romance. Love means simply to treat with some measure of respect. That you don't simply walk into the harem and say, I'll have this one tonight. That there's a certain delicacy which the Jewish family man was encouraged to show towards those women who were married to him. And the same thing of honor. And the guidance of children does not involve what we think of as guidance, patient listening, hand-holding, endless hours of getting over their cranks till you get to what the real issue is. Guidance in those days was something very specific. It meant that instead of simply giving your son his marriage portion and sending him out into the world, you gave him correction, you managed his business for a while, you supervised his life until you felt he was really capable of handling it for himself. It had nothing to do with being a pal. It had nothing to do with what being a father is involved in for most of us most of the time today. Now, having said all of that, that most of us are forget that we have a long history, and we assume that what happened in our generation or our parents' generation is somehow eternal, elemental in the Jewish tradition. And having said something about the limitation of the documentation in which I have to base myself, let me try and make my case. First, it's clear that outside of the Jewish tradition, certainly within it, the family has gone through major structural changes. From polygamy to monogamy, from the clan to the large extended family to the nuclear family. Those changes are very clear. The one I want to add, and the one which is not so clear, which people tend to push away from themselves, is the concept that the family has in fact changed in the last century from being a place where which one entered simply to perform certain necessary functions for the survival of a group of people, to being a place where human relationships intrude. Love, feeling, emotion, intimacy are modern entrance into family life. You can't find them in the family before the last two centuries. Startling, but let me try and make it. First, in the old world, in the traditional community, small traditional community, it was the community, not the family, which did the acculturation, which did the socialization, which did all those things which we associate with family life today, and which provided whatever intimacy people in fact had. I told you something about what marriage was. One came to marriage without any expectation of intimacy. One was trained to believe in these traditional families that there were two worlds, the world of women and the world of men. And these worlds should meet as rarely as possible. At the age of three, four, a boy was taken from his home and put to cheder. Now, cheder was a single-sex institution. Only boys were in cheder. And he spent 6 days a week at cheder, just with boys. And all of his teachers were men. And when he went with his father to do something, he went to the synagogue, which was the communal center and the social center and everything else, and he was downstairs in the man's world, not upstairs, in the Weiberschule, in the woman's world. And when he was brought by groomsmen, by his peer group, who had really been the group with which he had socialized, to the marriage altar, he met a woman with whom he would have children, and he immediately went back into the man's world. If he were a student, to the yeshiva, a single-sex school away from his home. If he were going to go into business, to those kinds of businesses that men engaged in. And he was taught all kinds of things about women that set up social distance. Amar besicha im ha'isha, maybe lidei hate. One who talks too much with a woman, or talks at all with a woman, will inevitably be led to sin. Women gossip. Women's talk is trivial. Women should be avoided. Not simply because they will entice you, but because their world is the world of the trivial. You're living in the real world. His friendships were all outside of the home. They were in the synagogue, downstairs, with the men. He cried when one of his friends died. I'm not so sure he cried when his wife died. Because he could always get another wife. And the wife whom he would get would bring to him a marriage dowry. He would actually be wealthier after having taken another wife. He very rarely talked with his wife. Very rarely. Except over the most mundane things. We think of a home as a table. How often do you think a husband and wife sat down at the same table? Very few people sat down 6 days of the week together. The seventh day, more often than not, if they sat down for a meal, the men sat down and the boys and the women served and stood behind the chairs. Or at the very most, they sat at the far end of the table. Communication? None. The men talked serious things. Women were, it was idle talk. It was an absolutely separate world. And the same thing, the picture can be drawn for women. The girl was born. She was raised cuddled as by a wet nurse. She was put to work with women's chores. She was not sent to school. She was domesticated by her mother or aunt or grandmother or somebody else in the home. She was kept there in the woman's world doing women's things, her friends being whatever little girls were not a cater of her age group, but mostly they were the adult world of the home in which she was a part. And then she was married off at 12 or 13 and put to work having children. And once she had children, we think instinctively of mother love. But this girl really couldn't afford to love her children in any sense that we mean, because she was going to lose one of every two children she had before the child reached 1 year of age. She was going to have multiple pregnancies, and she was going to lose a lot of children. How much of this kind of emotional carnage can you go through? So they steeled themselves against that. More than this, not only did they steel themselves against this kind of feeling, but she had not cuddled her child. By and large, she was so necessary to the stall in the market or to the work in the garden that she had to go back to work the day after she delivered. And there was a wet nurse in the village who took care of the children. She rarely handled the child. And more than that, children were a threat to her. It was almost suicidal to have a lot of children. And so one did not rejoice in becoming pregnant the way one does today. Now that's a far different picture, isn't it, than the quote Jewish family of tradition that we tend to think about. What it says, in fact, is that it was the community which established values, it was the community that socialized, it was the community that established identity, that insisted on norms, and it was through the community that Judaism was passed on from generation to generation. And I think one can make the case that the emergence of the families we love, we've known and loved, the nuclear family, the warm families in which we were raised, was in fact counterproductive, at least in the question, on the issue of the transmission of Jewish values and Jewish identity. And that's the next case I'd like to try and make. Now about 1750, perhaps a little earlier in Germany and in England, capitalism begins to emerge. The town begins to develop. Jews begin to think that there's a possibility of living someplace outside of the ghetto, of belonging in some kind of way. Now competition begins to beat in the breast of Jewish entrepreneurs and non-Jewish entrepreneurs. And they begin to pull up roots and to take with them parts of their family. And when they settle in Amsterdam or in Hamburg or in London, they leave behind in Poland or in the countryside the extended family. They come with just their immediate family. And they have to because of a problem of rights of domicile in one thing or another. And now the family becomes something new. It turns in on itself. Instead of being able to depend upon the larger community, it looks upon the larger community as something strange, frightening, and alien. We have locks on our doors. And those locks are symbolic of the fact that the world out there is not to be trusted. And beginning with urbanization, with capitalism, we move from the sense where of real neighborliness, of real community, to a sense where now we're a series of little islands. And if we're honest with ourselves, what happens in these islands is that the family is pared down to a basic minimum. Space, cost, all kinds of factors intrude here, mobility particularly. And we try and pull ourselves out from the world about in order to protect ourselves and protect our children from influences, from threats, which we consider more and more to be dangerous and to be baleful. How can I illustrate this? You remember the advertisement a few years ago, the family that prays together stays together? The old Jewish family never prayed together. Never. There were no such thing as family pews. There still isn't in the Orthodox community. They prayed apart. And that sense of separation was basic to it. Now the family pew comes in, the sense of people being together. And as for economic and political reasons, we build this shell against the outside world. We cut ourselves off from the community which gave us whatever friendship, whatever intimacy we had before. Now we've got to find that intimacy within the family context. And we begin to explore it. We begin to explore the relationship between husband and wife. They begin to talk to each other. They begin to realize of each other that they're persons. We begin to explore the relationship across the generations. First, the parent and child, and then to a certain degree, grown parent and grandparent. And all of a sudden, a new kind of world emerges. And the first indication of this new world is the intrusion into the home of mother love. which begins to show in the literature about 200 years ago. The husband now is the man who does the work. They're no longer on the farm with everybody with a whole set of chores, you know, busy constantly. The mother can be at home. There's nobody else to be at home. That becomes more and more her work. And once she's at home, she begins to handle the children. And if the husband's at all successful, he begins to be able to have a maid in the home who can help out with the chores, and she has more time to be with the children. And now, coincident with the emergence of capitalism, we begin to reduce the danger of childhood infant death, infant mortality. She doesn't have to face that great danger, at least to the degree she had before. She begins to cuddle, she begins to love, she begins to feel, and she begins to bring into herself, or to allow within herself, a whole series of emotions to be externalized, to be shown, that she had never allowed before. The capacity to be a mother had always been there. But the discipline which survival had required had held this down. And now she could allow her emotions, you know, to develop. And as she allowed her emotions to develop, she found she had other feelings besides mother love. She could love her husband. Strange idea. Very strange idea historically. And then if the mother loved her husband, she began to hope that her daughter might in fact love the man before the marriage that she would marry. And the second element of the modern home begins to intrude, romance. Well, obviously externally we'd say that simply about 150 years ago, the marriage broker began to lose business. And kids began to go out and to choose their own mates. Well, how did they choose? They fell in love, or whatever the term may have been. Romance intrudes, feeling intrudes. Now, once you fall in love, you're not going to be willing any longer to be an absolutely subservient person, or nor want to be an absolutely dominant person. Love includes friendship, intimacy, and a whole new emotional dimension intrudes into the Jewish family, into all modern families for this time. Mother love, and then the love of the adult for another adult, love of the husband for a wife, and then all those elements which I would call domesticity. All those elements which we've seen in our own homes and felt there. The pleasure of children being at the table and talking with us. It wasn't so long ago that children were to be seen and not heard, which was a carryover from the older tradition. Now children were part of our world. And now everyone in the home looked at the other as a person. And we began to see all kinds of possibilities. More importantly, we began to feel all kinds of emotional growth within ourselves. We were more complex. There was greater opportunity. Survival was easier. There was a greater amount of abundance. We weren't living so close to starvation, to the level of survival. All of these things made it possible for us to become emotional human beings who began to look on a marriage and family as a way to self-fulfillment, as a means to happiness. All kinds of things that you read about constantly in the Dear Abbey and other Bibles of modern time. Now that's what the modern home means to us, and in a sense how it came into being. And the modern Jewish home went right along with us. Except for us, we had a very special involvement in the new family. It came about the time we were asked to join the world. And it came about as a part of the great bourgeois revolutions of the 17th and 18th and 19th century that we felt ourselves to be a part of. It was our cachet. Belonging. We would have a home just like any other. We were a little closer to it because in the 17th century we really had explored some of the elements of the new capitalist system and come to the towns in England, Holland, Germany. But more importantly, we faced a world which was even more alien than the average non-Jew who was moving into the new social order faced. We faced a world ripe with anti-Semitism. Which meant very simply that when the non-Jew formed his family, he could still expect to have his eating club, his pub, his downtown club, his social structure of intimates who were of his own sex. And if you look at every social order, Germany, England, wherever it is, every nation, you'll see that they have some kind of context where the males maintain the sense of community friendships, which had been pre-modern. We Jews couldn't do it. We Jews couldn't do it because, in point of fact, we were not welcome. And so more than the non-Jewish world, we're just switching a cassette. We depended upon the cassette. More than non-Jews, we depended upon our families. And we began to explore the new world, to taste it more intimately. And I suggest to you that it's not a matter of chance that the first men to explore scientifically feeling and emotion were for the most part Jews, Freud, Adler, and all of them. Because it was the Jewish home which by their day had already had a generation or two in Vienna or in Berlin to be established, and some of the new opportunities and the problems which inevitably come with any new opportunity come to the fore. Now here we are with something that seems very great. We are now in a world which is happiness oriented, which aims at fulfillment. The family has created a new concept of persons. The family, the creation of the modern family has made it possible for the old sex divided, sex differentiated worlds to come together, and a sense of real one world has emerged. It's all to the good. But is it to the good for Judaism? Interesting question. In the old world, where there was a coherent traditional community, where Judaism was established by the community itself, their values were dominant. Everybody grew to have a Jewish identity, because everybody shared the same identity. And someplace in that community, there was something, somebody at least, who knew what Judaism was all about. A rabbi, a sage, somebody. But now we have nuclear families, shelled families, families within shells, wandering here and there. Not every nuclear family had a resident rabbi. And so Judaism became, in many of these families, more and more trivial. You know, it was reduced from concept to candles. And more in the nuclear family, the idiosyncrasies of the family become dominant. Families have personality. Families have certain concerns. They have their own calendar. More and more, their calendar became more important than the traditional calendar. More and more in the interests of the family, the values of the family became significant to its members. And the values may be very much at war with the conventional values of the Jewish world which they see about them. The nuclear family is not a very good way to transmit a religious tradition which emphasizes peoplehood, which emphasizes community. Because in point of fact, it needs reference outside the home. And the nuclear family was built up against community. Everything was to take place within the home. Your friendships were to be within the home. You had very few friendships that were meaningful outside the home. Well, you had companions, business associates, but very few intimacies outside the home. But the synagogue is outside the home. And so is the center. And so are all of these institutions. And the nuclear family is suspicious of all public institutions, all structures outside the family itself. Because there's an innate, built-in, inevitable conflict of values between each individual home and the consensus of the community itself. So I don't think we can make the case that Judaism depends upon the survival of the warm, emotional, nuclear family as we know it. Very clearly, this isn't the case. We've only looked at Israel, where faith and the faith community survive in kibbutzim and in places where the family has been transformed into something that's much more communal and something quite different. Now, I'm not talking about universal values at this point. I'm talking about very specific Jewish values. And the answer to the question I posed to us, can Judaism survive the end of the family, seems to me very clearly yes. It can, and one can conceive of structures in which the Judaism, the faith, will do much better than it has done under the nuclear family structure of which we're a part. But what about our own lives, quite apart from our Jewish lives? What about the growth of the next generation? What about the transmission of values? What about the whole process of acculturation? What's going to happen as the family disintegrates more and more under the pressures that are impinging on it. Well, nothing survives in the social order for long in simple chaos. We tend always to create new structures. If you look at what's happening out there, what you see is an incohate, undirected reaching out for community. You see it in many ways. You see it in the young, in their search for communes. You see it in their search for chaburot, in their interest in all these strange cults, in the ashrams and in Chabad and all of that. What are they looking for? What are they finding, more importantly? They're finding community. They're finding a series of relationships which are more intricate and more involved than the very limited relationships that the nuclear family permits. The nuclear family is devastating in one basic respect. It pulls you away from the rest of mankind. It does not train you well to operate in a very complex world filled with billions of earthlings. Now, the commune may not do it either, but at least there are many more relationships there, 20 or 30 instead of 3 or 4. And you find there a sense of community, which obviously many of our young people need desperately. And you see us doing the same thing. Think how many every other Wednesday cribbage groups have met for the last 50 years. Think how many, reading sodalities and groups of friends have met around a bridge table, or people have come together to read papers, or rotaries, or Kiwanises, or all of these groups, scouts, whatever level of generational level we're talking about. The problem with those, all of these, is they represent our need for friendship. But most of them are very superficial. We use these for business relationships, we use these to learn specific skills, but they don't really give us a network of intimate relationships which might really allow us to grow and to expand and to develop along new ways. And so we turn to those gurus or those fakers who will teach us to touch one another. And we run off to Southern California, to Enslin and places like that to learn to feel again. We've been turned in on ourselves so much that we've got to have people who can take off the strings from the corset, and let us simply be human again, which is one of the things that the post-nuclear family age is going to have to experiment with. The nuclear family has been a wonderful thing in many ways. It's given us a sharp sense of our individuality. It's given us a sharpened sense of the worth of people who are of different generations than we and of the other sex. All those things we owe to the nuclear family. But it has not given us stability or security, emotional security. And it has turned us away from a world at the very time when obviously we have to learn to live somehow in a very difficult world. It doesn't prepare us very well for life. Now, all kinds of experiments have taken place with post-family societies. The most interesting and the most studied is the Israeli kibbutz, of which we've talked in this seminar. Trouble with almost all of these groupings is that they are rare, very few people are involved, and we really don't know the long-term consequences of living within and being conditioned by these kinds of values. But it seems very clear to me that in the next generation or two, as the family is more and more dissolved under the acid of the changes which are taking place now, that there's going to be a greater and greater turning towards these kinds of structures. And if Jews want to be, or any other group want to be concerned about survival, about continuity, we had better be experimenting with them and seeing what kind of structures we can come up with, rather than wringing our hands and berating, the passage of the good old days. Because just as the extended family and all of that is behind us, it will not be reclaimed. So to a large degree, I'm afraid that if you look at the mass of people, the industrial age has come to the point, the technological age, where the nuclear family is going to be, has been reshaped beyond reclamation in terms of what we knew. And what we salvage from it, what we create, is going to have to be something new. Well, okay. shocked yourself enough. I never thought I'd heard myself saying some of these things. And let's talk about it. Who wants to start? What do you draw from all of that?
Well, I don't know, but why are our Jewish children so lost that they have to turn to
me? Well, first of all, let me say one thing. All of a sudden, the cults have become a fascinating topic of pop conversation. Usually when that happens, they're on their way out. The Moonies were much more significant 2 years ago than they are today. And the numbers of youngsters who are involved in these cults are in the tens and the hundreds, not in the thousands and the tens of thousands. We're not talking about a large number of kids. And we ought not, I'm saying this because we ought not to be looking at these aberrations which any kind of convulsed society is going to throw up and base strategies for the future on the basis of these. It's a tragedy when a child becomes involved in something like the Moonies because they're being used. But if we look at the larger question and ask why children are being caught, adolescents, they're not children, why adolescents are being caught up in so many of these commune movements, why any group that wants to get off the ground today has to promise something beyond, you know, a political objective, it has to give emotional satisfaction and has to talk in almost religious terms. The answer lies in what I've been trying to say, that the youngsters raised in the most traditional of family structures are the least prepared for the coldness of the world out there. They go to the Moonies because you love them too much. It's a terrible thing to say. But it's not just to the Moonies. They need something from the world, because we have sensitized them to feeling, much more than our grandparents were ever sensitized to feeling. I don't know if you ever picked up the old Yiddish newspapers of 1890, 1900 in New York. There was a regular column in almost all the newspapers, wanted missing persons. Men who deserted their wives, children who abandoned their families. How could they do it? The answer is that most of them really didn't care. They'd never been trained to feel. We train our children from infancy to feel, to care. We love them. We want them to love us. You do love us. We say it 1,000 different ways to them. You know, we kiss them. We fondle them. We love them. Express it. And then they get thrown out into a world which is cold and cruel and competitive. And they're frightened. Can't you remember when you first had it, when you were about 13, 14, 15, saying, how am I ever going to earn enough money to survive in this world? You're earning 12 cents, you know, by babysitting, or 15 cents by carrying bags at the grocery store all day. How will I ever be able to afford a family or a home? Can't imagine how you're going to do it. Well, these kids are now 18 or 17 when they're thrown out from the cold world. They've been taught to feel. Some of them have found they can't feel at home because their parents have been too busy doing other things that are involved with feeling, and they're looking for somebody who'll love them. And if you want to love children, I can find you a way of I'll find you 1,000 children who will follow you like puppy dogs, as long as you give them love and some sense of direction. It's not hard. I didn't. I don't know what.
Maybe a devil might be.
What is the story, Ernie?
It's about the number of single divorced women's statistics. Adults, 35, over 35,
Well, if you know, you know, one of the interesting things that is how the women's movement has, for the moment, run out of steam. And largely because, it, like every all of our hyped up promises, it promised more than any movement can in fact deliver. You know, and you were going to fulfill yourself as well as have a job, or the vote, or whatever, you know, the issue of the moment was. And these are the to a large degree, this is part of the cost, these are the victims of social and legal change. They're also the victims of a new kind of change. And that is that there's a new sexual emotional revolution going on, which goes beyond romanticism and feeling, which are all very nice and very healthy, which strips romance and feeling out of the relationship, where the sexuality of the relationship itself becomes an end in itself. And that's one of the factors in what some have called this the second sexual revolution. No one knows where that's going to go. But we see it particularly among the youngsters in their 20s. And it's partially a reaction to the coldness of the world. They're afraid to give themselves over romantically in terms and feeling to somebody else, because then you are locked into a relationship with all of the, you know, the emotional cost that's involved there. One of the things which we've got to recognize is that we are going to pay a terrible, we are paying a terrible, terrible price for having promised our children the moon. For having promised them that anything they want to do, they can do. Promised them that any kind of thing they want to achieve, they can achieve. Any kind of relationship they want to have, they can have. And it simply isn't so. And one of the things we've got to do is to damper down this whole thing. Eleanor. Well, I have a number of questions and some half articulated. But the you're saying several things. First is we don't know. The rate, you made a statement, the rate of intermarriage is so high we may not have to worry about Jewish survival. We don't know what the consequences of intermarriage are. There's outmarriage and there's in-marriage. There is marriage in which a couple moves into the Jewish, one of the couple moves into the Jewish world. The marriage is where the couple moves out of the Jewish world. We don't know whether more people move in or out that way than we'll say of couples who are Jewish who marry, you know, drift away, or individuals who never marry and drift away or come in. Again, this is one of the pop themes of the last two or three years. It is a serious problem, but it's a problem that there's more hand-wringing about than factual information about. My own experience here makes me feel that we gain a good bit from some of these intermarriages. How much, I don't know. We make, oh, I would guess 40 converts a year here at the temple. And so I'm not convinced that, you know, that it's the time yet to throw up our hands and give up. Secondly, the question of how one should handle intermarriage, which is the other question. Intermarriage should be handled by the individuals involved, not the rabbi's job. The rabbi's job is to teach Judaism or to organize the marriage within the Jewish tradition. That's what a Masadir Kiddushin is. My job is not to take young kids who haven't the faintest idea of what they're doing except that they lust for somebody else, and to tell them that they haven't thought through the consequences of what they're doing, or to sanctify that lust by organizing the wedding as if it were Jewish, for the benefit of the parents or grandparents who are there. My job is to make them conscious of the consequences of what they're doing, as it is in any counseling relationship. And I do that best when I force reality on them, rather than allow them to deny reality. But you know, you can't make the faith into what you want. The faith is has disciplines. And you either agree with them and are part of them or you're not. Jewish life has lost tens of thousands of people in every generation. That's part of the reason we've survived. We represented perhaps 5 million people in the first century. By normal laws of population growth, we ought to be 100 million or 200 million people today or more. Why aren't we? Well, it's not simply because of these wonderful pogroms and oppressions we tend to trot out from time to time. That was a little part of it. But the major part of it was Jews assimilated, Jews converted, Jews disappeared. And there's a kind of basic core who understood what it was all about and who stayed close. Now, the question of the family's relationship to human marriage and all that is a different one. The question of faith's relationship, it seems to me, very clear. Faith is not, I had a little girl call me today, it's a typical kind of example. Her parents resigned from the temple 6 months ago. The oldest sibling has joined Chabad. And now this one said, called me up to tell me that she was going to get married and the boy was non-Jewish. And they both believed in God and therefore I should marry them. And I said, you know, Judaism isn't the belief in God. And she had no conception. Well, she didn't want it to be, because I taught her way back when what it was. But she was not willing to think of Judaism as something besides some kind of vague theism. The whole intricate relationship of faith and peoples has no meaning. It has no meaning because it had no meaning in the home, and obviously it was a home where people were searching for something much more, each child in its own way. All we can do is maintain the integrity of the tradition, and people will go its own way. Jewish societies have disappeared. Judaism has survived. And it may be what I've suggested to you is in fact the case. Over a long period of time, the American Jewish community may disappear, I don't know. But certainly we have established, in Israel at least, a larger community which will give reinforcement to the Jewishness of its members during a long period of cultural and other transition as it evolves into something different. No. Now stop. This is not an evening on intermarriage. But let's clear up the air. Intermarriage is not coming from Reform Judaism. It's coming across the board. There's as much intermarriage out of Orthodox homes as out of Reform homes, and there's twice the amount of intermarriage out of non-affiliated homes than out of affiliated homes, whatever the denomination. Intermarriage varies not so much with affiliation and unaffiliation, as it does with the size of the community. The smaller the community, the greater the rate of intermarriage. It has nothing to do with religious affiliation there. It just has to do with propinquity, with all of this. And one of the things that you're going to have to, Jews who care about the survival of Judaism are going to have to make up their minds to do, is to provide the whole context of youth groups, college age groups, which are Jewish, in which the youngster can go and meet and mingle and be part of and grow in the faith as well as in their human context. And the very fact that they make these contacts increases their chance of marrying within the tradition and then therefore of remaining Jewish. And the problem that we have in a congregation like this is very simple. We confirm 60, 70 youngsters a year. 15 or 20 of these come back to the youth group. The very age where they are most susceptible to making their emotional relationships, you pull them away from us. You say they've been confirmed, that's what it's all about. That's where the issue is just beginning. We've got to have those contacts, and we have a whole series of, you know, all kinds of programs designed for them. College level is all kinds of programs in most places that could pick them up. But Jewish parents don't want their children to be too Jewish, as a matter of fact, if the truth be told. They want them to marry Jewish but not be Jewish. It's an interesting kind of combination. And so they want them to make all kinds of contacts. And it's more important that they be skiing or that they be doing something else than that they be involved in these kinds of activities. Luke? Sure. Well, you know, you're trying to maintain your family, I'm trying to maintain my family. What I'm suggesting to you is that it's going to be a harder and harder proposition to do. It's going to be a harder and harder proposition to do because the outside world is making more and more intrusions on the family, and it's less and less your family or my family, and in our children's generation, it will be less and less theirs. If it is in fact the case that a child spends, the average American child spends something like 30 hours a week in front of the television set, spends another 30 hours a week in school, and the rest on the playground, how much is that child really a member of that family? How much is the family really influencing that child? And where are the influences taking place? Yes, the child is in the home. Yes, there's a kind of guardianship involved. Yes, there is a love relationship, which is very basic. All these are to the good. And the family, as I tried to say, has done so many beautiful things and good things across the world. But is it really my family in the sense that it was a generation ago, in your parents' generation or their parents' generation, where the family was really very distinctive and very dominant, and family values, you know, were clear. As I see what's happening in the 20, 30-year-old group, I see a group of youngsters trying very hard to establish families as we know it. I see another group of young people who are living a family community life. It's a strange kind of thing, which really hasn't taken form as yet. But they have a group of very good friends with whom they do a lot of things. The family is not as encapsulated as it once was. Now, how they're going to manage all this, given the mobility of the society, how they're going to manage all this when their children come along, and I don't know. But they're certainly struggling to create a series of intimate friendship relationships outside the family, which most of us, you know, do not have. It's a noble effort, Luke. And I've turned the television set in our family off as much as you, I know, turned it off in yours. But the question is a question of numbers. Ultimately, the numbers of the world out there wear you down if you determine that your child shall be part of that larger world. You can win it. You can keep the family if you're willing to go the Mennonite way, or the Amish way, or the Chabad way. That is, if you are willing to turn your family completely away from the larger world, which most of us are not, that's what really what almost identification with the Reformed congregation means. If you are willing to do that, you certainly can achieve it. There's some guarantee of success. But if you're not, you're going to be caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. Constantly. And your children are going to take many of the things that we gave them, our children are, and they're going to have to compromise with the realities which they find 10 years out, 20 years out, you know, as they come along. Just a moment, excuse me.
Have you discussed this with the, let's say, kids, quote, that would be our oldest, and their attitude toward what you just said would be interesting? In, for example, we love you too much, or not to expect everything you go for you can get, just keep going.
You know, all year long I've been on one theme in a thousand variations. And the theme is in terms of lowering the level of expectation. I started Rosh Hashanah when I talked about the messianic journey as opposed to, you know, vaulting ambitions. I think that most of the younger people understand that better than their parents do. Because the world, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, is clearly not the place that is going to be transformed by some magic wand, some small group of radicals or reformers or something else into the messianic age. And the kids are much more realistic. We see them in school today, much more aware of the problems, therefore much more likely to try and establish families and to go through all the heartache and that goes with it. But you know, families today are terribly costly. And I'm not talking just about financial costs, college education, you know, this kind of thing. Families came into being largely because everybody had a job to perform and you needed all those hands to do everything that needed to be done. Today, children get in the way. Today, adults get in the children's way and children get in the adults' way. But particularly, I think of the other. Our homes do not need children. Children give us very little day-to-day satisfaction, or at least we think they do. We associate, because of the pop culture, children with problems, thesaurus. We know we train our children up deliberately to let them leave us. We don't want to become dependent upon our children. So for us children, you know, in a very real sense, I think for most people that we have children simply because our parents had children. And we think it's going to work out nicely. It should. The books say it should. But we don't discover until we're way into it, you know, some of the real satisfactions that come with being a parent. And increasingly, being a parent is a tension-fraught activity. It really is.
It is. Like 10 years ago.
Yeah. 20 years ago, I didn't. You know, we had children because I had a happy childhood.
I didn't.
So did my wife.
I just wondered if through each changing, as we change, just.
I hope we do.
Sorry.
What?
Are you sorry that?
No.
Not our fault.
What? In many ways, and for many parents, it is. No. If you are trained and conditioned that your greatest satisfactions come from being a mother or a father, it is the greatest satisfaction you can have in your life. If your goals are to be a successful doctor or lawyer or Indian chief, it can be the greatest handicap that you could have, and your children will be a constant source of a shackle to you, holding you back. That I see very much now in our world. We saw it in fathers for the last 2-3 generations. They paid no attention to their children until a certain age. Literally, so it was left to the mother. And later on, it turned around. That's why I told you I was going to shock you tonight before we were through Allison. Yes?
Yeah, I think I haven't touched on something that I think that's pretty clear in the office. So the shameful things from now before and now. What happened to
that? What? Well, in the old families, but I want to pick up something. You assume that in the
old excuse me.
Yeah. But you assume that with the old ghetto family there was gratitude. There wasn't. One of the happiest days in the ghetto was when father died and the money was to be distributed. Because there was no emotional context to the relationship between parents and fathers and sons. They were often in business competition with each other. No. And the adults, there are 100 documents which are fascinating. Wills, ghetto contracts, in which the father stipulates precisely what care must be given to him and to, in his old age. He rarely worries about the wife, by the way, but what care he must have in his old age if he doesn't get 1700. All right, I'm glad you picked me up on that. I'm talking about 1700, 1600, even 1800. Then there was no gratitude. Then we moved into a world where the modern family, our family, emerged. And what we're reacting to is the fact that our families were good. And they were warm. And they were successful for us. And there were places where we had a great deal of happiness. And there was, to a certain degree, a decent relationship. Not as perfect as we tend to think when we look back by a long shot, but better than anything that existed in family relationships up to that time. But now, a whole new set of factors have taken over. And one of these factors is liberation, individualism, doing my own thing. I want to do my thing. The husband said that 100 years ago. And so he went to work and he stayed downtown and stayed out as late as he felt he needed to. And he traveled whenever he needed to and he dumped it all on the wife. And now, he did it in terms of providing for the family, but it was also freeing him from certain other relationships. And now the wife has done the same thing. And the adolescent did it about 25 years ago or 35 years ago. And the whole context now is that to create a community which will provide a series of institutions which will do what the family used to do and therefore take care of us in illness, in age, when there's mental problems of one kind or another, when there are welfare problems of one kind or another. And these relationships, these institutions are becoming more dominant. Mindy. No, I don't think that's what I'm trying to say. Family begins with marriage, or so we thought, at least with some kind of basic agreement, for better or for worse. And marriage was taken for granted several generations ago and then way back in time. Now, obviously, it is no longer taken for granted. But interestingly, though it is no longer taken for granted, some of the side effects of the earlier life have tended to disappear. And that is the prevalence of men having mistresses who they, going to prostitutes. The relationship, premarital relationships now tend to be more constant. The kids are looking for something in them, some of them. It's more sensitive and beyond just sex.
the whole cult that's just sexist, in that sense, sexual in that sense. But the one who establishes the lasting relationship, to bring the girlfriends home, the friends home, are seeking for something that is more.